Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 233 of the Fun with Cars Formula One podcast for coverage of the Spanish Grand Prix from Barcelona. I'm Robin Warner, and I am once again joined by the man some call the Siesta Assassin, Christopher Roche. Hi, Chris.
I do like to wake people up when they're sleeping mid-afternoon. That is true. Hello, Robin. How are you doing?
Today, we're going to cover the fifth round of the F1 Championship, as well as the fifth round of the IndyCar Series. The latter will be much briefer, because I doubt Chris watched it. For full schedules of all four series that we like to cover, please go to funwithcars.com/schedules. But without further delay, in Spain, it was this new no-name kid that no one's ever heard of or talked about ever. Lewis Hamilton in the Mercedes that won the race, quite handedly so. In second place was his teammate, Valtteri Bottas, making it a Mercedes 1-2. And Lewis Hamilton was over 20 seconds clear of Valtteri at the checkered flag. Third place went to Red Bull Max Verstappen. In fourth place was the lead Ferrari of Sebastian Vettel. Fifth place went to the second Red Bull in Daniel Ricciardo. Sixth place, Haas Ferrari. He was the lead Haas Ferrari in sixth place. I'm not exactly remembering where the other Haas finished, so I'll have to... I'm sure it's coming up soon. In seventh place was Carlos Sainz in the Renault, top Renault. Eighth place went to Fernando Alonso, the top McLaren. Ninth place went to Sergio Perez in the top Force India. And 10th place went to Charles Leclerc in the top Sauber. A lot of tops. 11th place went to Lance Stroll. Out of the points, but the top Williams, just in the points, not so bad. 12th place, yes, another top, went to Scuderia Toro Rosso Honda and Brenda Hartley. 13th, Marcus Ericsson in the second Sauber. 14th, Sergei Sorokin in the Williams, second Williams. And then we have a bunch of non-completes, not classifieds. Stoffel Van Dorn in the McLaren Renault. Esteban Ocon in the Force India Mercedes. Kimi Raikkonen in the Ferrari. Romain Grosjean in the Haas Ferrari. Something tells me we're going to be talking more about him in a moment. And partially because we'll also be talking about Pierre Gasly in the second Scuderia Toro Rosso Honda and Nico Hülkenberg in the Renault. Wow. Talking. Okay. Chris, what'd you think?
I think I'm going to start with the fact that Fernando Alonso won a race.
He won a race not in Formula One. In fact, he had fenders over his wheels, and it was a Prius, if I remember correctly. It was a Prius, right? Was it an autocross?
It was a glorified Prius in a WEC, and the reason why I bring it up is because it almost celebrated the fifth anniversary of him not winning anything at all, which I think is rather shocking for a man of his talent. So, I just thought I'd bring that up, but we can now talk about the race.
Yeah, well, and I'm very happy that you did so. We did mention that in the last podcast that Fernando Alonso won in the World Endurance Championship, and it was a fantastic result for him. And Chris is absolutely right that it was just about 5 years on from his last win, which was in a Formula One car. It was a fascinating result for Fernando. Alas, he could do no better than eighth back in the Formula One car, which is a shame because I'm sure the chassis is world class.
Yeah, so a lot of teams brought a lot of updates and were extraordinarily positive about them until they started running the cars on the track and found out that, the order's largely the same, other than Mercedes in Barcelona, at least, was able to leapfrog Ferrari. Mercedes locking out the front row on the grid and then the top two steps of the podium. And it was even worse than that for Ferrari fans because the pace of Lewis compared to Vettel at the start of the race was extraordinary. He was pulling away at a second a lap and using less of his tyres as he did so. A bad weekend for Ferrari. Kimi had two engine failures, which has now put him... I think they may be able to salvage the engine that he was using on Sunday. It sounds like it was an electronics issue that was the problem there, but the actual engine may not need to be replaced. But he had a failure earlier in the weekend that had to be replaced. So now he's one third through his allotment of engines, which now puts him behind in terms of getting the Ferrari upgrade for Canada. And, at the end of the day, we had the sad sight of Vettel unable to even make a run at an overtake on Verstappen, who was wounded. I mean, he'd knocked his front wing end plate off. in a tussle with Lance Stroll, and but never looked threatened, did he really? So bad, really shocking compared to the pace of the Ferrari and Baku. That was not what I was expecting, that Mercedes would turn up at Barca and trounce them. So really, really strange result. And it'll be curious to see if this now continues or if this was a one-off and Ferrari will bounce back in either Monaco or subsequent Grand Prix.
Well, the only thing I'm going to say in response to that was the weather on Sunday in Catalonia was, or in Barcelona or wherever, I don't know how we want to call this, was quite a bit cooler than what was going on in the weekend and indeed what people were expecting in general. And I do know that tire temperature sensitivity and the chassis and how the chassis develops heat in the tire and then wears the tire plays a huge role in maximum performance. And maybe, especially with the updates Mercedes did, maybe the temperature of the track and the air played in Mercedes' hands a little bit, which maybe inflated their advantage for this particular weekend. That's just one. I'm not saying that's definitely the case. I'm just saying it's possible.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. That could be possible. I mean, one of the things that we've seen, and Hamilton's been lamenting, is Ferrari's ability to seemingly set their car up on any track in any weather conditions. Because if you recall, in China, it was unusually cool there, and Ferrari were able to get their car dialed in and be very quick compared to the Mercedes. So, yeah, a very strange twist in the 2018 championship. I don't think anyone was expecting one of the teams to get such a big step on any of the others because, you know, Red Bull were disappointed that they didn't make a bigger step forward, right? They were still some way off the ultimate pace, 7/10 or so. So they were disappointed with their package. I think McLaren were largely disappointed they hadn't made further progress. A lot of dramatic front end developments on their car. It looked like a bit of like a snowplow in some respects and it sort of drove like one too. I mean, you could argue that, you know, McLaren were quicker than Renault in qualifying, but it was by one place, not a lot of time. And then Sainz managed to get Alonso back in the race. Maybe they've caught a little bit up with Renault, but that's not really where McLaren expected to be. And then you got the likes of Williams that were dead last in qualifying. I mean,
that was so hard. That was heartbreaking. There's just no other way to say it, especially after the Baku result being encouraging as it was.
Yeah, exactly. And then Kubica got a drive in FP1, said he was embarrassed by the run in terms of how slow he was, but yet somehow still was quicker than either of the two prime drivers in both FP1 and FP2. So just, yeah, it's a sorry situation at Williams. Well, they've fired their chief designer, by all accounts, so the heads are starting to roll.
Since you mentioned that, though, I mean, how much longer is Sergei Sorokin going to last here? I mean, his performance has been dreadful. For Lance Stroll to become your lead driver by a healthy margin, that is not because Lance Stroll has progressed as a driver so much. That's because you have wonderful, wonderful drivers in every respect except for Formula One. These guys just aren't quite up to it. And they're your example of what the car is capable of. And I'm having a hard time with that. To see how consistent Lance Stroll has outpaced Sergei Sorokin, to me, is troubling.
Yeah, but if my name was Gene Haas, I'd be eyeing Sorokin up as my number two driver. I mean, Sorokin's bad, but Grosjean is an unmitigated disaster at the moment. Wow. What is he doing?
Okay, I guess that's Chris Roche's version of a segue. That is definitely a siesta assassin version of a segue. Yeah, he's had a bad couple of races.
Oh, man, that was epic. I mean, to lose it behind your teammate and then keep your foot in going across the track and wiping two of the cars out, it's just despicable, honestly. It's just the most heinous thing I've seen in an F1 car since
Baku.
Maldonado used to do that frequently, I guess.
Since Baku, when he just lost it in a yellow flag.
Well, yeah, but he didn't take anyone out, did he? I mean, why did he keep his foot in?
Because he was trying to save the car. That's how you do it.
Okay. Note to self, next time I'm doing a track day.
He didn't. But he was trying to. And that shows commitment, as far as I'm concerned. No, I'll be honest with you. I had more sympathy for Grosjean at first when I saw the footage, because he's taking this line. The car in front, and it was Magnussen, wasn't it, did kind of jerk to the left in the middle of the corner. It's a long, sweeping corner. Did kind of jerk to the left, and that caught him off guard. Now, did he overreact? Of course. But it wasn't like just all of a sudden nothing was going on and it happened. There was something that caught his attention and caused that reaction. To me, that's something.
Yeah, I mean, no, that was absolutely clear in the replay. And, okay, so he then goes off in the outside of the corner. That all is fairly understandable. I think we can all say, yep, he got caught out, made a mistake. But to then create an almighty smoke cloud as you then careen across the track with the rest of the F1 grid, you know, making the turn, I just don't understand that, how he thought that was a good plan. I mean, all you do is you spin off into the tarmac area, runoff area, and you rejoin in 20th place, don't you? I mean, that's just logical. You don't just, out of a fit of pique or frustration, just decide to keep your boot in. I mean, to me, this is a guy who wants to end his F1 career pretty quickly. He's 19 points behind Magnussen, and we're 5 races in. He hasn't scored a point yet. The car's been arguably, you know, probably the fifth quickest car on the grid.
Well, it's been fast enough that people have been accusing them of cheating. I mean, that's a sign.
You could argue it's been quicker than the Renault and the McLaren. And what's he done with it? Nothing. It's nothing. He hasn't scored a point yet.
Yeah. You know, it reminds me a lot of Romain Grosjean a few years back. You must remember that infamous accident at Spa, at the beginning of the Spa event. I can't remember which year that was. I feel like that was before the hybrid era. So maybe 2012, 2013. You know what I'm talking about? It was the start of the race. First lap into the turn one hairpin, and he just took out 3 or 4 guys in the process.
Yeah, did he get a penalty? He got a warning, driver warning for that, didn't he? Or a penalty?
Yeah, I think he was like on probation for a few races and maybe even not allowed to run the next event. They took it pretty seriously. And from there, he pushed on, he got beyond that, and had some pretty darn strong drives in the meantime. Got the Haas drive, and he certainly was ahead of, his name's escaping me, the Mexican driver. I want to say Carlos Munoz, but that's IndyCar now. But
So not Perez? Or Esteban Ocon?
No, not Ocon. It's either way. I'll think of it when it's not helpful. he outdrove his original teammate at Haas, and... And things were looking up. And then
was it Gutierrez?
There you go, Gutierrez. And now he seems to be reverting back to these old ways. And yeah, I agree with you. It's hard to explain, hard to understand.
Look, I mean, I'm not writing off his whole career. Grosjean's been quick. There's no doubt that in some races he's blown away his teammates. And I think he basically bossed Magnussen for most of last season, didn't he? But he's having a poor year, no doubt. And the fact that he now is under significant pressure, 2 big mistakes in 2 Grand Prix and scoreless, when your teammates, you know, chalking up the points consistently, that's going to put a lot, you know. I don't think he's mentally the strongest driver. You know, he needs a nice, safe, warm environment where he feels appreciated and nurtured. I think he's in real trouble. And the fact that his countrymen, both Leclerc and Gasly, are driving so well, I think probably doesn't help him either. So in the French press, he's probably getting fairly pilloried while his countrymen are being praised. So I can see this going really badly wrong for him if he doesn't get a few solid Grand Prix under his belt here. And, you know, you wonder whether or not the mistake came from the fact that he was trying to get a run on Magnussen and try and pass him, do a Nico Rosberg on Hamilton. You know, I mean, that could have been going through his mind, and that's why he ended up making the mistake he did. Who knows? But because, you know, that inter-team battle, I mean, it's everything for these guys in the midfield. It's all about beating your teammate to try and get into a better seat. So yeah, that doesn't look good. Anyway, I think we've beaten that one to death. But yeah, really comical. Comical performance.
I think that had this happened in isolation, there would be some different attitudes about it. But the fact that this happened the weekend after he binned the car during a yellow flag at Baku just was such a compounding that, you know, this is compound interest, right? And his reputation is compounding pretty fast. And so now he's got to come into in what I regard in many ways as the most difficult circuit of the year to Monaco.
Oh gosh.
And keep his nose clean. There's no other way around it here.
Yeah. I think I might start becoming a betting man and place a bet that he's not going to finish that race. I have no idea what odds I'll get. But I don't think that's going to go well, honestly. And then he'll probably go and win. So I wasn't very praiseworthy of Ferrari's race. But one thing that did catch my eye was Charles Leclerc had a strong race again. He didn't qualify that well, but as you mentioned earlier, he snuck a point. He is a racy individual at the moment, but what fascinated me was that you could clearly see that there's now a two-horse race in the engine stakes, that Ferrari and Mercedes now have a sizable performance advantage over Renault and Honda, because Alonso couldn't get near a passing maneuver on Leclerc.
Yeah, that's exactly, you know, right.
Just had no grunt at all, even with the DRS. Just could not even take a look into turn one. So it just shows you how much more, you know, I mean, obviously there could be a difference in the wing settings and the Sauber could have been running lower downforce, but I was still surprised at the pace of the Ferrari-powered cars throughout the weekend.
You have to give some credit to the Sauber chassis as well. I mean, they are really making some good grounds with that chassis. And you mentioned this a couple podcasts ago, and we're absolutely right in doing so, that Sauber has a history of being quite quick, in fact, quite swift with their chassis. In fact, it was Kimi Raikkonen's rookie year was with Sauber, and he performed very well. I think he finished in the points. And that was back when you had to be sixth or better to be in the points in his opening race with the Sauber. So it's nice to see that Sauber is starting to regain some of their footing. And that Ferrari power, or, you know, I don't know if they're calling it Alfa Romeo power or not, but it's nice to see that they're on the up again. And I have to say, it's become a quite stressful season for Marcus Ericsson, because his CV for Formula One racing has kind of always been on the bubble, and now with Charles Leclerc there, it's looking dicier still.
So we've written two current F1 drivers off. So,
I have not written Grosjean off. I'm just saying he's just having a string of terrible luck.
Terrible luck.
But oh no! Oh, but you know what? I guess we have written off too, because Sergei Sorokin was the one I was really questioning.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So you're right. We're two, actually, yeah. Two and a half, maybe.
Between us. No, I know that you can count Grosjean as terrible luck. It's just total incompetence. I'm sorry, but no, I can't let you have that one. That's not poor luck. There was no mitigating circumstances in either case for him. Just poor driving.
This is what I love about England. You guys just don't, you know, I guess it's my Midwest sensibility to try to give Guy a little bit more credit and the benefit of the doubt. And you're like, right. no, there's no benefits here.
Well, he is a Frenchman. We have quite a long history with the French, so we don't tend to be too forgiving toward each other.
This is true. This is true. Yeah, this is a digression for sure, but I was once just doing a random history and just popped up, and I was like, oh, good Lord, England and France were fighting long before the U.S. was a factor in any way. Like, obviously, I should have known that, but I just, lost my train of thought, and it's like, oh, yeah, that history is actually pretty old and continues on today in Formula One, and I love it.
Absolutely. Yeah, the Spanish battle was fascinating as well. The Carlos Sainz, Fernando Alonso battle of the Spanish Titans. Sainz put away Hülkenberg pretty convincingly over the course of the weekend. I think Hulk had some car trouble, didn't he? He seemed to be struggling in qualifying, which is unusual for him. But that's interesting, that inter-team dynamic. Carlos seems to be holding his own and now even maybe getting slightly ahead. So
if you'll allow me, bad luck has definitely gone Hülkenberg's way this season. Obviously, there's nothing Nico could have done short of clairvoyance to avoid Grosjean in Spain. And, you know, he's had, I guess he kind of did it to himself a little bit in Azerbaijan. But, yeah, he's had a bad string as well.
Yeah. But, I mean, I think absolutely there was nothing he could do in that instance. But, you know, Hülkenberg, ended Palmer's career rather effortlessly. It didn't even look like he broke into a sweat last season, right? He was just convincingly quicker than Palmer. And, you know, that's the way F1 should be. It should be about the best drivers in the best cars. And so we all think that's fair enough. I think, you know, there's a lot of talk about who's going where for next year. You know, we've got neither Mercedes driver confirmed for next season. We've got Daniel Ricciardo out of a drive potentially at the end of the year. We've got maybe Kimi Raikkonen seat up for grabs. I wouldn't be surprised if Carlos ended up in a top seat for next year. I think he really merits a good drive. I mean, we've seen what Verstappen's been able to do at Red Bull. Sainz was neck and neck with him when they were teammates at STR. So he needs to be picked up by someone. And you know, Renault's making improvements, but I don't think they're going to be race winners next season either. I think it's going to take them a little bit longer than that to get back on the top step. So I think there's another maybe year or two in their project. But he should go be promoted to the Red Bull seat if Daniel leaves.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think Carlos has done very well for himself. That's something I pointed out when Verstappen originally was promoted to Red Bull Racing. It was like, you know, gosh, I'm not sure that was quite so straightforward if Carlos might have been a better choice. I mean, Verstappen's pace is really hard to argue with, but Carlos Sainz's maturity is, to me, the balancing act between those two. As you've said, I think you're absolutely right that since making the move to Renault, he's performed very, very well. And, you know, that began last season, towards the end of last season, when he was put in place of Palmer for the last, I don't know what it was, three or four Grand Prix. So, yeah, he's done very well. Top team, you know, Renault is a factory team. So they are one of the big boys in that sense. They're an engine supplier. That puts them in good stead as well. But it would be hard to argue with the established pace of Ferrari or Mercedes. But I thought you said last race podcast, that he was connected to Red Bull still, that Red Bull still kind of had a string they could pull him back if they wanted to.
Oh, absolutely. He is still a Red Bull driver, so they could pull him back in if Ricciardo decides to leave. But I think Renault have actually started negotiations to try and see if they can keep him for next season.
I see. Okay. Well, there,
so I think
there
it's really in Red Bull's court. So depending on who they want to have drive for them next year, whether Ricciardo will re-sign for them, which I guess will depend on whether Red Bull go for Honda engines or not.
Jeez. Yeah, you know.
How did Honda do this weekend? You haven't spoken too much about them. Did they not finish in the points?
Well, okay. It's true they didn't, but it's also true that Brendan Hartley has struggled mightily. Speaking of struggling, we're having a bit of a drivers that are struggling kind of a podcast.
We are, yes.
Brendan has been consistently outperformed by Pierre Gasly. Pierre Gasly was the one that finished fifth for Honda a couple Grand Prix ago. Brendan celebrated his first point only last race. And, you know, considering everything that was going on in Spain, I thought Brendan performed admirably. But Pierre Gasly was one of the victims of Romain Grosjean's smoke bomb. And I think there's a very reasonable chance that maybe he would not have been ahead of Fernando Alonso, but that Pierre Gasly could have gotten the Toro Rosso in the points and we would have had a slightly different conversation. I think Honda is making the least power of the engine manufacturers, but I don't think there's a huge gap between Renault and Honda right now. I really don't.
No, I think you're right. I think Honda has probably closed in on Renault, and their reliability seems to be better. I don't know if that cloud was assisted by Gasly and a detonating Honda, but I'm being cruel now. No, I think
you just want that to be the case. You're just trying to will that to happen.
No, I think they definitely are, you know, light years ahead of where they were for the last three seasons. And if they'd shown this step last season, then we may still have a McLaren Honda running around out there. But it is interesting that they have made such a step. And if they can continue to do so, then, you know, maybe they'll actually, you know, get pretty competitive here in a few years.
I just love your Honda timelines. To me, that is the most humorous. That's the funniest thing you say every podcast. You know, we're kind of running down this theme. I want to keep it going. There's been a lot of big separation between teammates once you get out of the top three. And Stoffel Van Dorn, yet again, you know, he's going up against arguably the hardest teammate to go up against. But his performance, considering that, it hasn't been as dire as some others, but it's only been so-so.
Yeah, but it's hard enough going against Alonso on a normal Grand Prix weekend, but Alonso at home, when he's, you know, even more fired up as usual, is pretty challenging. I don't think he was a million miles off, was he, in Q2? I think they were very close, and Alonso just snuck in into Q3, which made that look a little worse than it was for Van Dorn. I think he's being respectable. I don't think we've got a Grosjean situation going on here. So I think, but it will develop, and if he continues to get you know, put in the shade, then that won't help his career long term, for sure. And I there was a interesting rumor floating around that McLaren are lining up a young up and coming British driver to replace Alonso if he should decide to move on at the end of the season. I'm not sure where he'd go actually within Formula One, but that's interesting that they're even considering that possibility, that they may have to consider a different driver at some point fairly soon.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I do feel like McLaren is a little bit in a weird place where they're starting to get a touch desperate to find the next Lewis Hamilton. And, you know, I feel like they might have been throwing away the good for the sake of the perfect, or for the sake of the great. And maybe they're losing out on good here in the process. You know, there's a lot of good drivers on the market. And if they just keep looking for the latest, greatest unknown rookies, they might be in the game of catching up for a long, long time.
Yeah, but the guy I'm talking about, I think his name is it Lando Norris? I mean, I think he's...
Oh, yeah. I know that name.
Yeah, one of the better up-and-coming drivers. So it's not like they're just searching the wilderness of SCCA racing to find a rookie driver here. It is the stepladder to F1. And I think he's been one of their drivers for a few seasons. But
you sure they're not scouting radio-controlled driving car? It's like, hey, you know, that's where the real talent is.
Well, it did work out rather well with Hamilton, didn't it?
Well. You know, anyway, let me ask you a question. How often can you have a once-in-a-generation driver? To me, I would think once-in-a-generation, but I don't know. Like, yeah, I'm just that stupid American we talked about.
You know, I was thinking about this over the weekend, and I think someone mentioned that Lewis had broken one of Schumacher's records, which I think was...
Yeah, wins from pole. He was his 41st.
41, yeah, exactly. Which and someone asked Lewis what his thoughts were on that, and he commented that, like, he looked up to Senna. Schumacher was obviously an idol of his, and he can't quite believe he's in the mix on these records. But... You know, you think back to when Schumacher was in his pomp and just dominating Formula One, and there weren't that many great drivers at that time, really. I think we've had this conversation before, but, you know, you had Mika Hakkinen, and then it gets very sort of mediocre. I mean, David Coulthard, like the guy, but never going to be classified as one of the greats. You know, you had Jacques Villeneuve, who you personally detest. you know, Damon Hill, another lovely bloke, but, you know, no one's ever going to put him in the top 100 list, are they? So, you know, you got a list, there was Schumacher, and then there was Mika, and then there was sort of a long, big gap to everyone else. But you look at the field now, and you've got so many drivers that I think will be regarded as outstanding drivers in one way or another, certainly compared to that era. You know, it's funny how Formula One comes and goes, isn't it? And you have these rich veins of just extraordinary talent at the same time. I mean, you go back to the Senna, Prost, Piquet, Mansell days, all amazing drivers in their own respect. I mean, obviously Senna was the best of those. But Prost was pretty special too, a different type of driver. But, you know, the challenge there was much greater in some respects than in other areas of F1.
I think that's fair, but I have to push back on that a little bit. I think a big part of why Schumacher and Ferrari were so successful, it wasn't just that they had Schumacher. This was also they had Jean Todt, they had Ross Braun, they had a real powerhouse team, and this was the era when testing was much more open, and Ferrari could outspend everybody by a big, big margin. I think there were a lot of potentially great drivers in that field in that era that just were overshadowed by such a dominant era by Ferrari. I mean, they tested all the time, and they had more money than anyone.
I think you're absolutely right if you go from like 2000 through to 4, definitely. But if you go pre-2000, if you go 99 back to when Schumacher was running in the Benettons in 91, right? You look at that period of time.
Well,
of course,
he was Jordan in 91, and then I think when Benetton in 93 or something.
Yeah. And then 4-5 when he won his
his first two titles. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, I mean, obviously there was an overlap with Senna, and they had some good battles, and he caught the tail end of Mansell's career when Mansell dominated in 92. But then, you know, when those guys were no longer on the scene, there was there was Prost in 94. And, I mean, he humiliated Prost. I mean, you go back. I mean, there were times where Schumacher was, well, maybe that's a little bit rich. I think I should take that one back. But there were times when Schumacher I'm thinking 95, 96, 97, he just seemed unbeatable. And that was even when Williams were winning in 96 and 97. There were weekends where Schumacher just seemed on a different plane.
Well, that's funny. That was Damon Hill and Jacques Villeneuve, the guys we just discussed.
I mean, Hill was absolutely annihilated by Schumacher in 95. And Williams had already decided that they couldn't have him in the car any longer, which is why he lost his seat at the end of 96, even though he won the championship, because they'd already made the decision they didn't want him in the car any longer, because he suffered so badly at the hands of Schumacher in the prior season. So, you know, it's... I was thinking more of those years than the 2000s when he dominated in the Ferrari, and it was just overwhelming, wasn't it? And it was hard to really compare drivers in that era. I agree with you, but now it seems so much more even, and you've got different drivers who, if the car's set up well, they can take the win. I guess that's a testimony to the sort of evenness of the top chassis at the moment, and the competitiveness and the confidence of the drivers, you know. So it's good. I mean, you can, at least five or six drivers are in the mix. I mean, you look at Bottas. I mean, he's had a tough first five races. He has been very strong. He was just pipped by, 0.04 of a second to pole position. And, you know, he was right there and thereabouts on Hamilton's pace, even though Hamilton was having a good weekend. So, you know, he's showing good development. And mentally, he's showing a lot of strength, that despite the setbacks that he's had so far this season, he's still pushing very hard and being very competitive.
Well, and to that end, it is Lewis Hamilton that is leading the championship with 95 points. Sebastian Vettel is second with 78. Valtteri Bottas third with 58. That's a big drop. Kimi Raikkonen fourth with 48. And I want to make a point right now that Kimi Raikkonen has definitely been unlucky. That is not a sign of skill. Daniel Ricciardo is ahead of his teammate with 47 points, Verstappen with 33 in sixth. And then it's Fernando Alonso, seventh in the championship with 32 points, Nico Hülkenberg eighth with 22, Magnussen ninth with 19, Carlos Sainz tied with 19, And then we go down and down and down, and you have to get to Romain Grosjean and Sergei Sorokin. Neither of them have yet to score a point, which means amongst all the other drivers, Brendan Hartley is also ahead of Romain Grosjean and Sergei Sorokin. It's been quite a fascinating championship so far, and I have to say I'm incredibly excited for Monaco. It's going to be a good one.
Yeah, and I fully expect Red Bull to win there, honestly.
Well, there you have it. But it's time to move on. Okay, there was more racing that happened that weren't Formula One cars. It was IndyCar, and it is the month of May, which now means it's time for the IndyCar GP. And it is the road course built into Indianapolis Motor Speedway that Formula One itself used a version of several years ago. And it was Penske driver Will Power that won that race, handedly so. We did a very good job. Scott Dixon finished second in his Target Chip Ganassi car. Oh, it's not Target anymore. It's the Chip Ganassi Racing, but it's not Target anymore. Apologies for that. Robert Whitkins, the Canadian, finished third. He's been a very strong rookie this year. He won with DTM experience. And former F1 driver Sebastian Borte, he was fourth. And my personal favorite, Alexander Rossi, was fifth. Elio Castroneves was back in IndyCar. He's going to be in the IndyCar for the entire month of May. He competed in this race, and he will be in the Indianapolis 500. He finished sixth. James Hinchcliffe with seventh. The next Penske driver after Elio, Simon Pagenaud, was eighth. Graham Rahal, son of Bobby Rahal, was ninth. And last year's Indianapolis 500 winner Takuma Sato was 10th. It was yet another good race. This one was a little bit more straightforward than the others, but IndyCar continues to put on a good show. I continue to implore Christopher Roush to watch the races. He continues to not do so. One day, the beer is going to be warm enough that he will actually come over and watch one with me. I don't know when that day will be. It's been on the boil for quite some time now. But we'll get it there. The temperature will go up high enough, I promise.
So how come they used to take an entire month to set the cars up for the Indy 500, and now they can squeeze another race halfway through the month of May? What did they change that allowed them to do that?
Well, you know, if you go back 4 or 5 decades, IndyCar, the rules were much more open. People were much more inventive, had different ideas, different things to share, and there'd be sometimes 75, 80 cars that were practicing and attempting to qualify to be amongst the 33 that actually qualified for the event, which kept the place much busier. These days, there is hope that there might potentially be a bump day that's legitimate, that there's going to be more than 33 drivers attempting to qualify, but we're talking about 34, 35, not anything like 70 or 80. And the cars are effectively spec aside from choosing a Chevrolet or a Honda engine. So there's a lot more predictability built into the capability of the cars. It's just modern racing having an effect on all the series. It's as simple as that. So to me, this was a pretty clever way of keeping the excitement of the month of May going by adding this road course. I'm actually quite happy with the decision.
The 500's been on my bucket list forever. I haven't made it to a 500 yet since I've been in the States. I did attend a couple of the F1 races in Indianapolis, so I have been to the track. And it is one of those places that sort of give you the chills and the goosebumps, because you just know it's steeped in history, and it is quite an amazing place, actually. I really would like to go to the 500. I really don't know why I've never been. So one day I could actually commit myself to going. But have you been?
Yeah, I have. I was at the 99th running of the race, and I was lucky enough to go as a journalist. So I was treated to a little bit more space and a little bit more bathroom access than the average fan.
okay.
And I have to say, you're absolutely right. The place is electric. I mean, it holds 250,000 people, and it's filled to the brim. The excitement that's there and the energy that is there is nothing I've experienced before. I have to say that it's a worthy bucket list item. If you can go and be in the grandstands and be anywhere near the start-finish, I think you'd find it quite impressive. Turn one, I think of all the turns, for some reason, turn one seems to have the most attempts at passes. If you're a road racing guy like me, none of this stuff makes sense. It's just novel, but it's really, there's something unique about it. You know, the whole energy and the pomp and circumstance, but also it's an oval, but it's 2.5 miles with only 6 degrees of banking. So the corners are quite large. The radius is massive, you know, whatever it is, 1,600 feet or something. But the cars don't get a lot of help from the banking. So it's in real life, it's much dicier than it appears on television.
Oh, that's what struck me when I got there the first time, was how narrow the track looked. And considering they do 230, 240 miles per hour, certainly in qualifying, I was shocked at... You know, I expected it, you know, when you go and watch an F1 race for the first time, somewhere like Silverstone, it always seems bigger than it does on television.
Yeah, yeah.
Indy was the reverse. It looked narrower and tighter. And it must just feel like you're driving through a tunnel, I think. And you get a little bit of sense of that on the onboard footage. But then, you know, they're going three wide through some of the turns. I mean, it's just amazing, actually.
Yeah.
So it's definitely got to be done soon.
And I've interviewed, quite a few drivers that have raced in the Indy 500, and it is 100% consistent. You know, Elio Castroneves desperately loves the Indianapolis 500. Juan Pablo Montoya loves the Indianapolis 500. Catherine Legg loves the Indy 500. That's the race she wants to do in IndyCar more than anything else. And with Legg specifically, I called her out. I said, it's an oval. You're going around in circles. How's that possible? And she says, it's so much more than that. You have to think so much ahead of time, and you're going so fast, and the crowd there, it's incredible. And she was saying that if you're attempting to make a pass, that oftentimes you're starting to execute that pass 2 laps before the pass actually happens, because there's so much to think about to set it up properly. And I think it's those type of calculations and challenge that really turns the drivers on. And because the drivers are always so engaged to perform so well, that's part of what makes it such a great show.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, it's one of the races that I always try and watch. And obviously, you know what channel it's on, which is helpful, because IndyCar I think they try and make it a game of chicken and egg as to where the race might be shown any one weekend. So.
Well, it's funny you say that, though, because it's been ABC for a long, long time.
Mm-hmm. But somehow I still can't find it. It's random. I think it's random times and days as well. It's like Friday at 2. What? What's that all about?
Well, yes, the Indy 500 is always Sunday at, I think it's Sunday at noon. I think the race starts right around noon. And the race coverage usually starts at 11. But the actual ceremonies at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway start at like 8:30. And it is one thing after another after another. And when you're there in person, it's engaging. So it's pretty incredible the way they set it up.
So another interesting tidbit is that McLaren are rumored to be on the verge of entering IndyCar. Did you hear that one?
I've heard rumors of that. I think that's largely because of Mr. Zach Brown and his ideas. And we'll see how much merit it really has. I have a feeling that when it actually comes, push to shove, there'll be more pushback than he's expecting.
Well, apparently the owners think it's perfectly acceptable as long as it's commercially viable, which, seeing as he hasn't brought any money to the F1 team, would seem... unlikely then that it's commercially viable, because apparently all the sponsorship on the McLaren, other than I think Shandon or Johnny Walker, is Fernando Alonso's personal leisure wear company, which I'm pretty sure he's not paying for that space. So I just think maybe they're deferring his salary by giving him space on the car, which is, that's a pretty big fall for McLaren, really, when you think about it, in the days of their Marlboro sponsorship and Vodafone and... My goodness.
Well, I'm sure Ron Dennis is an avid fan of this podcast, and I'm sure he's cheering for what you just said right now.
I'm sure he's very, very unhappy and probably is scheming it away to retake control.
Right. But let's move on. I think it is time for some trivia. Wait. Okay, so last time I asked everyone... And the question was this. Miami is set to host a Formula One race next year on the streets of the beautiful beachfront city. When was the last street race held in the U.S. and where? And Chris, you correctly guessed that it was Phoenix, but you incorrectly said 1989. I think you were thinking of the first time they raced in Phoenix, but I was going after the last time they raced in Phoenix because it was the most recent time they had a street race. So it was 1991 in the streets of Phoenix, and it was the opening round of the championship, and Ayrton Senna won that race. And interestingly enough, and I was actually a little disappointed when I remembered that this wasn't the case, but before Phoenix, it was actually the city of Detroit, which is very near me and you, that was a street race before Phoenix. So that was the question. There was the answer. So you were close, sir, but just not quite there.
So when I think of Phoenix, I can't remember which year it was, but obviously Senna, I think Senna won at least once out of those 3 years. But do you remember the driver that burst onto the scene at Phoenix that gave Senna a run for his money for at least a couple of laps?
Michael Schumacher. Michael Andretti, his teammate. No, that was 93. No, couldn't have been. Was it Michael Schumacher?
No, it was not. It was a young Frenchman. I'll give you a clue.
Oh, okay. Young Frenchman who's no longer young. It was Romain Grosjean.
Jean Alesi was
driving. I thought Jean Alesi was Italian. That just shows you how ignorant I am.
He is a French Sicilian, I think was how he classified himself.
Ah.
I think he raced under a French flag, and he was driving, I believe, a Tyrrell. And he announced himself by going wheel to wheel with Senna on the streets of Phoenix. Of course, he only ever won one race, but people at that time thought very highly of him.
He once put on, it was this simple, it was a Honda, like I think it was a Honda Civic Type R street drive in Europe. I'm sorry, it was a racetrack, but it was a road car drive in Europe. And Jean Alesi took his wife on a lap, and she started screaming at him the entire lap that she thought he was going to kill her. And then it was only at the end of the lap that she realized the camera was on. And it's very good. I'm sure if you look up Honda Civic Type R and Jean Alesi, that would be one of the top things on YouTube.
sounds funny, yeah.
But anyway, okay. It is time for a new trivia question. And this one, I am holding out hope that you are not going to know instantly. The Spanish Grand Prix has been held at the Catalunya Circuit since, wow, let me say that again, has been held at the Catalunya Circuit since 1991. But it was actually held at four other venues since 1950. Among those four other venues, which one held the race most often and who won the inaugural race at that venue? That's a question. It's layered, that one.
Yeah, you've gone deep for that one. I'll give you credit. I'm going to, can I wildly guess, or do you want to allow the listeners to think about it without my...
No, wildly guess away. It was not Silverstone.
Oh, sorry. Can you just, you're not talking Spanish Grand Prix then?
No, I am doing Spanish Grand Prix, and I'm helping you out by telling you that the Silverstone was never the Spanish Grand Prix.
Good. Thank you. That's very helpful. The other Spanish race that I always read about, because I'm an enormous F1 geek, as people may have noticed, is Montjuic Park. Maybe that's not the right way to pronounce that, but that's what I'm going to go with. So I apologize for any native Spanish speakers. But I believe that held the race for many years. It was quite the track back in the 50s and 60s. As far as who could have won then, I mean, I'm probably wrong on that answer, but let's just keep going, digging a grave here. I'm going to say it was probably someone way back then. Let's go for Phil Hill. How about that?
Lovely, lovely. Well, everyone else is going to have to wait and to hear the answer. And until then, I want to let everyone know about the upcoming race schedule. The sixth round of Formula One is going to happen at the Monaco Grand Prix on the 27th of May. And it's also the sixth round of IndyCar at the Indianapolis 500. Yes, our next races are the big ones. This is the weekend for that. The second round of the World Endurance Championship is the 24 Hours of Le Mans. So, yes, there were three for three. And the fifth round of the IMSA race is actually going to be in Detroit going to be a 100-minute event on the 2nd of June. And when IMSA races in Detroit, IndyCar is also going to race in Detroit that day and going to race the following day. IndyCar does this thing called the Duel in Detroit. That's D-U-A-L in Detroit. Two races, one on Saturday, one on Sunday. And IMSA is also a big part of that weekend. So I will be at that track, keeping myself quite busy during my day job. But that's going to be a great event. So the difference is that IndyCar has a little something going on in between now and then.
So can I add something very briefly? For those listeners who are in the Metro Detroit area, if you want to drive the track on Belle Isle, it's actually set up. And inadvertently, I ended up driving myself on Sunday. Admittedly, at a slightly slower pace than IndyCar drivers. But it's all set up, all the concrete walls and everything, and you can just drive around on it. I'm pretty sure you get stopped if you try and do a racing lap. But if you just want to go and get a flavour for what that track layout's actually like and cruise around on a push bike or in your road car, you can do it right now. So it's kind of cool.
And there are a lot of facets of the track. Despite it not being a terribly long track, there are some pretty darn quick corners. There's two different pavements. There's concrete. There's asphalt. And it's when it's not an IndyCar track, it is a state park, Belle Isle State Park. And yeah, so it has to be open to the public.
Exactly. And now they've set the track up nice and early. You can go drive it until they dismantle it in June.
Yes, that's exactly the case. I'll admit, I wasn't there to see Chris Roche driving, and it would have been great. I am a little bit more excited for IndyCar and IMSA to show up. But anyway, I want to thank you for listening. Please take a moment to review us on iTunes or on whatever platform you get our podcast. Please leave comments on the podcast of your choice by going to funwithcars.com. As always, I can be reached at feedback@funwithcars.com. Tweet us at fun_with_cars and check out our Facebook page at facebook.com/FWCars. Chris, thank you for joining us. I'm Robin Warner. Goodbye.
All this witty repartee is not being generated for our valued listeners, so we should get going with the intro, I think.
Oh, that's what you think. This is all gold. Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 230.